Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to New Books in Indian Religions, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Shruti Dixit, the host of the channel. Today, we'll be talking to Professor Anustubh Basu about his book Hindutva as Political Monotheism, published by Duke University Press in 2020. Professor Basu is a professor in English, Media, Cinema Studies, and Criticism at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. Apart from his book Hindutva as Political Monotheism, he is also the author of Bollywood in the Age of New Media, The Geo-Televisual Aesthetic, and the co-author of volumes Intermedia in South Asia, The Fourth Screen, and Figurations in Indian Film. Interestingly, he is also a film producer and made the Bengali feature Herbert, 2005, which won the Indian National Award for the Best Regional Film. Professor Basu, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Shruti. It's a pleasure.
I wonder if you could begin the interview by telling us a bit about yourself.
Well, I was born and raised in North Bengal, in the small town of Siliguri. It's about 80 miles from Darjeeling. And I spent my school years there and then went to Calcutta, Jadavpur University, for my college and university master's. And then moved to the United States to do a PhD at the University of Pittsburgh. And I have been a professor at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign since 2005. So it has been a journey. But I go back to India almost every year. And no matter what I write on in terms of, immediate topics, I think I'm basically a student of this very complicated and many-armed project called Indian Modernity. So that is, in a sense, my first book was sort of led up to my second book, because in both these projects, I was trying to understand a certain shift in the Indian cultural and political imagination that came into being in the early 90s with liberalization, with the media explosion, and the political rise of the Hindu right. And that is what I have been trying to look at in my books and essays from various perspectives. So in a sense, I belong to that particular generation that, saw, that sort of, I was in my early 20s when Babri Masjid happened. And then I also belong to that generation that saw the explosion of Indian media in the, roughly from the mid-90s onwards. We who had grown up with two Doordarshan channels, two television channels on state TV, we were suddenly sort of inundated with images and, vistas from across the world. And I have tried to sort of understand that moment as best as I can.
Thank you, Professor Basu. That is indeed a journey. I guess the book Hindutva as Political Monotheism comes from experience. So just a quick question, how did you come to write the phenomenal book Hindutva as a Political Monotheism?
Well, I had written a few, standalone essays that have been published over the years. And then I started thinking about this particular moment that we are inhabiting. Many are calling it Hindutva 2.0, that is a Hindutva that has a very profound electronic dimension to it, you know, that comes of age in the age of Twitter or Facebook or very rapid transmission of words and images across the world. And so that is where I started thinking. And then, in a sense, the project sort of worked itself backwards. That is, I kept going back to the history and the origin points of not just, you know, nationalist projects, but also ideas. Ideas, attitudes, mythologies, etc. And that is how it happened. I was actually working on an entirely different book, and I interrupted that to write this one.
That's interesting.
Go ahead.
In chapter one, named Questions Concerning the Hindu Political, you talk about the Orientalist roots of Hindutva as an ideology by drawing connections between Carl Schmitt's idea of political theology and Hindu nationalism. Can you elaborate it for the audience, Professor?
Yes. So I believe that, you know, contrary to what Hindu nationalists say, the project of Hindu nationalism is essentially an Orientalist, imitative, and you know, Eurocentric one. Well, we can begin with the idea of nationhood. Now, you know, nations can be imagined from many angles. You know, you have a common memory of migration, for instance, a common memory of withstanding some sort of natural or political disaster, common memory of fighting colonialism, and you know, so on and so forth. So nations can be imagined in various ways, and India has been imagined in various ways. But if one has to propose a religious nationhood or something that, in effect, even if you call it cultural nationalism, it in effect comes with a very strong religiosity of purpose, then there is something that needs to be taken into account. Because, you know, the model of the nation and religious nation is essentially not Indian in a larger sense. It is something. It's an idea imported from Europe. Although, you know, people are trying in various ways to contest that. But if the nation has to be a religious nation, then if we look at the history of political thinking in modern Europe, you know, over the last few centuries, then there is one consistent condition that is built into that. That is, if you want to have a religious nation, the religion itself has to be a monotheism. That is a kind of a faith that is cast in Abrahamic terms, right? It's pretty consistent, and I show that in the book. It's pretty consistent in Hobbes, in Rousseau, in Locke, in James Mill, in John Stuart Mill, and any other figure that you can think of. That is, there is an implicit understanding that at the end of the day, Germany has to be Protestant Germany, and, you know, it's as per natural course of events, England has to be Anglican England, or Spain has to be Catholic Spain, right? So, and when we talk about nations, the nation form, the nation model, it comes out, you know, out of the European experience, you know, roughly from, let's say, the Peace of Westphalia in 1648, it comes out of a moment when, you know, when just prior to that, all these European constituencies had a spate of religious wars, the mid-millennial religious wars, right? So that is the experience, historical experience, from which the nation form and its particularities, its overt and covert demands, all these things come. Now, the reason I use Schmitt is because Schmitt, you know, as people will know, Carl Schmitt was a Nazi jurist, a Catholic, interestingly, Nazi jurist who wrote, you know, a highly conservative but extremely brilliant thinker, who wrote on political theology in the 1920s. And what I found interesting is that what he said was that a nation is, and he uses the term political, that is, the idea of the political that creates the nation as well as the sovereignty principle of the nation. That is, the principle on which the nation fixes its identity as well as its sovereign claim. What Schmitt says is that this idea is built on a friend-enemy relation. That is, a fundamental friend-enemy self-other relation. And that relation is defined by political jealousy. That is, in other words, at the end of the day, the nation has to ask itself, who are the real people? That is, real people defined in terms of a monotheistic flock, a congregation, a brotherhood. And who might be residents, and who are the others who might be residents of the nation state, but do not belong to that core brotherhood, right? That is, would be the minorities, the Jews or the Anabaptists, etc. And so what Schmitt says is that that is the essential, you know, the essential basis of national identity, because you have to ask yourself, who are the people amongst us who can be trusted to perform what he calls secular martyrdom? That is, who are the people who can be trusted to lay down their lives for the nation without any consideration for their own salvation, right? So that is the transfer from the theological to the secular. So in other words, to, you know, just put it very succinctly, this is how Schmitt will look at the historical formations of Europe, that is, Anglican England, where you can't trust the Catholics, or Catholic Spain, where you can trust only the Catholics, or, you know, Protestant Germany, right? So, in other words, there is a final analysis question that at the end of the day, what theophilosophical determination can you come forward with when it comes to the nation? Now, again, I should remind ourselves that this doesn't mean that this is the only way one can imagine a nation. Nations can be imagined in various ways. But the reason why this is pertinent is that is what I feel the Hindutva movement has been trying to do for the, you know, roughly for about 100 years. But even before that, there was a certain trajectory of the Indian modernity experience that headed in the direction, that direction. And that direction was to recast Hinduism, which is a gargantuan, extremely complex assemblage of a million different kinds of pieties. The project has been to invent Hinduism as a political monotheism. That is, to give to the Hindu experience certain Western structures that it never had, like a holy book, like a common code of laws, like a universal church. Universal church in order to create a homogeneous Hindu brotherhood, a congregation, which can, as per the European experience, be transformed into a political fraternity. Right? So that has been the project. But once you say that, you can understand the various problems inherent in the project. Now, Carl Schmitt was writing in a Europe where nation states have, a lot of them have been created on the basis of, one language, one culture, one denomination, etc. Right? And we have that model from Herder and the German idealists, romanticists onwards. But again, so the problem is, how can you transplant that model in an India where there are so many languages and so many cultures? How can you imagine a unified Hindu identity, a congregational identity, without addressing the caste system? That is, how can the Hindus be a congregation in a classical sense when, according to traditional strictures, they can't even sit together at a place, without violating caste rules? So this has been the Hindutva project, that is, imposing this model, whether consciously or unconsciously, and simultaneously trying to address a very formidable Indian plurality of worship, of cultural modes, customs, language, etc. Right, and we see these points of tension all the time. Lately, for instance, there was this debate about vegetarianism. It's an ongoing debate. The problem is, unlike, let's say, the Abrahamic model, where you can define a true faithful, here it's very difficult to say that Hindus are not, ideal Hindus are vegetarians. The point is barely 30% of Hindus are vegetarians, right? And so on and so forth. So that is what the Hindu right has been traditionally trying to do. It created the Vishwa Hindu Parishad, the VHP, as that kind of a model that would supply a unitary church to the Hindu experience. It wants to encourage Hindus to sort of take up Hindi as the unifying language, which obviously, not all people are in agreement with. It sort of dilly-dallies with the question of caste. That is, it finds it difficult to address caste as a theological, as a traditional institution. But at the same time, it would like to institute a kind of a common identity through through institutions like the RSS, where you have common uniforms and common eating areas, presumably for all castes, right? So these are the points of tension in the project of political monotheism that I try to address in the book.
Thank you, Professor Basu. Hinduism are indeed many and not one. And on that line of thought, in chapter 2, The Hindu Nation as Organism, you talk at length about the complications that accompany the Hindutva insistence on original Varna system. So can you just say a few words on the same?
There has always been this debate, and the most famous one of the 20th century would be the one between Gandhi / Radhakrishnan and Ambedkar, right? That is, you know, the debate that there was this original Varna system, and it has been described in various ways, right, as scientific management of labor, as division of labor, etc., etc. So there was this ideal Varna system that was perverted, particularly once, you know, Islam arrived in India. And it sort of dissipated into like thousands of jatis, which are these, historically contingent hybrid formations. So the Varna system was apparently pure and perfect working principle, and there was nothing wrong with that. It has also been argued that it wasn't hereditary. So, you know, each person was given equal opportunities, if you showed talents as a warrior, they made you a kshatriya. If you had intellectual talents, you became a Brahmin, and so on and so forth. But I show through my obviously historians have pointed out that it can be argued that the jati system actually precedes Varna. And Varna is an ideal, idealized system, which probably in its pure form never existed anywhere. Right? And that is what I try to demonstrate in my reading of especially the Manusmriti, which, you know, talks about Varna. In Manusmriti, what you see is an ideal Vedic village. And I use the term village advisedly, because there is also a kind of an undercurrent of dislike about big urbanization, right? And we can come to that later. So Manusmriti, which was written in a period when there were various ruling formations in North India, some very strongly Buddhist, some very strongly Jain, some sort of Brahmin, like the Sunga dynasty. So it was written in a period of relative turmoil, right? And the scenario that it proposes, the order, the social order that it proposes, is an idealized one. It's very difficult to create a modern society out of that. And that was my basic point, because it has been a consistent argument, especially in relation to the Indian constitution. It's been a consistent argument from certain sections of the Hindu right, that the ideal Hindu, the essential Hindu existence should be as per the social order described in the Manusmriti. But what I try to point out in the book is that that Varna system, again, you know, noting that it, you know, it sort of it doesn't exist in a pure form anywhere, even in Manusmriti, right? Manu cites about, I think, 15 jatis that result almost automatically due to, sexual commerce between the four major varnas. So the social question becomes, so what do we do with these mixed caste people? And there is a, you know, catalog of rules for them. But what is interesting in almost, in all this is that you cannot imagine a territorial continuum that covers the entire society. It is always a society that is, it's an apartheid society in the sense it's always a society that's made of boundaries, inside, outside. This is where you can go, this is where you cannot go. That is where you can stay, that is where you cannot stay, and so on and so forth. In other words, there are some castes who can stay only in the marketplace, let's say. There are some castes who can just pass through the Vedic village without being able to live there. And then finally, there are other castes who just simply cannot enter the Vedic village. So the question is, how can you build a national society on those principles? Right? When that that village actually doesn't want to be anything bigger than that. It needs an outside. It needs an outside where people can be exiled or where people can be ostracized. So how can you transplant that into a modern nation state space where, where everyone has to be included, at least territorially speaking, right? So that is what I found interesting about this Varna imagination, that there was, there was a pristine moment somewhere where everything worked, and then, it got corrupted, it did not work anymore, and it sort of bred complications, historical complications that need to be addressed. But what I'm, what I try to show is that no matter how far you go back, you can't come up with a social principle of Varna that is not exclusivist, or to put it differently, that is not, that does not discriminate and ostracize people, right? So if you ask Monu, for instance, at one point, what he says is that he virtually admits that what he is proposing is possible only in regions where Brahmins have hegemony and are numerically significant. And he expressly advises all Vedantins not to live in areas dominated by Shudras, right? So there is always an interior, exterior, inside, outside distinction working in that text. So this, I look at that, I look at Bhagavad Gita some, and try to understand this question about this, so-called tension between an ideal Varna and a sad but historically, forced dissipation of the Hindu polity, as they put it, into like literally thousands of jatis.
Addressing the caste question was indeed an important one in the book, Hindutva as a Political Monotheism, Professor. So Based on the third chapter titled The Indian Monotheism, would you like to explain your perspective of the present-day Hindutva battle against Mahatma Gandhi?
Right. So in the third chapter, I look at I don't look specifically at Hindutva, but I look at a certain trajectory of Indian modernity itself, and the emergence, the 19th century emergence of a Hindu identity. Right. So, roughly speaking, this is something almost nowadays everyone knows, that the Hindu used to be largely a geographical identity. That is, anyone who lived east of the river Indus. Right. And you can, from there, you can basically come to a moment in 1911 where, 2 lakh Muslims in the state of Gujarat registered themselves as Mohammedan Hindus in the census, right? So it had a very long career as primarily a geographical identity, and insofar as Hinduism is concerned, it is, I think even Hindu nationalists would readily agree that it is a Western concept, and it's reliant on a certain, religious anthropological definition of religion, right? Religion as a particular European context that tries to define faith and customs and cosmologies, etc. Right, so Hindu right people would readily agree that the term Hinduism is a new one, and they prefer Sanatan Dharma, etc. And a few others. So Hinduism never existed. Probably the most significant, the first most significant public use of the word was by Raja Ramon Roy in 1816. I haven't found anything significant prior to that. It was probably used by some priests in the journals in the 1790s, but nothing significant. So, this is how we started. The Warren Hastings administration wanted to define a denomination using, a Western model of reckoning. So, the Hindus needed a holy book, and the book had to be a good one. So that is how it came into being, primarily from Charles Wilkins's 1718 translation, that they identified, let's make Bhagavad Gita the holy book, the Hindu Bible. Or earlier, it was decided that Manu Sriti should be the Hindu code of laws. I mean, they didn't even use the word Hindu. It was called Gentu in those times, around 1772. Gentu coming from the Portuguese gentio, or pagan, right? So, if we think about this, these two moments, right? Bhagavad Gita being made the Hindu Bible. Traditionally speaking, I think Vaishnavas would be very happy with that, but maybe not so much the Shaivites, right? Or if you think of Manu as this, single code of Hindu law, as opposed to about, I think, a dozen other Dharma Shastras that were available. What it does is also destroy an immense tradition of local laws, customs, and jurisprudence, right? So that is how it all began, that we needed a Hinduism, and it had to be an axiomatic Hinduism. That is, one, a Hinduism that can sort of engulf all the immense varieties of faith experience, right? Something we can call monistic, polytheistic, henotheistic, that's another term, animist, etc., nature worshipping, and atheists, lokayats, right? So all these people have to be called Hindu in a political sense and cultural sense. And that's an impulse that began, you know, in the latter half of the 18th century and carried on throughout the 19th century. I mean, and if we look at orders like the Brahmo Samaj, or which was Brahmo Samaj was called the Unitary Church of Hinduism, Unitary Church of the Vedantic order, or later the Arya Samaj. All of these institutions, the Prarthana Sabha, etc., were trying to invent a Hindu congregation. And what the RSS and the Sangh Parivar did from the roughly from the second decade of the 20th century is to give it a political dimension and collect what has been called, collect and cultivate political, what I'm calling political jealousy, right? Now, where does Gandhi come in? Gandhi's problem, the Sangh Parivar's problem with Gandhi is that he, you know, Gandhi was someone who spoke a language that was highly Hindu, right? But at the same time, with very secret cosmopolitan deliberations, right? So when he talked about Ram Raj, for him it was the same as Khudai Raj, right? Or the order of Jesus, etc. So for the Hindu right, the problem was that Gandhi had captured the political imagination of the country. He's the person who took nationalism to the interiors and villages, right? Prior to him, the Congress was basically a high class debating society almost, right? So, but at the same time, this titanic paternalistic figure who was inventing what you would call a political congregation, a political mass, this figure refused to cultivate what can be called political jealousy in that mass. That is, he refused to divide that mass into categorically Hindu, categorically Muslim populations at war with each other, both impelled with political jealousy. So, that is where Gandhi's very looming presence and his, his ahimsa disturbs the agenda, the purpose of inculcating political jealousy, on which sort of fundamentalist Hindu nationalism is based. Right, he is a father who has been, for that very reason, who has been called someone who is, Pacific, androgynous. There's a lot of interest in, Gandhi's, sexuality, as well as someone who is who disrupts the emergence of an aggressive Hindu masculinity with his with his ahimsa. So that was, and Gandhi, of course, was a very complicated figure. And on the other hand, you had Gandhi's debates with Ambedkar, which also features in the book, the kind of paternalism, traditionalist paternalism, anti-industrial, anti-modern paternalism that Gandhi preached Ambedkar repeatedly pointed out, couldn't address the many caste atrocities that defined and still continue to define Indian social life. But just to come back to the Gandhi Sangh Parivar tension, I think the point is actually pretty simple. If there is a Hindu imagination of polity and political language, Gandhi owns that. And that is where it becomes a fight with the Hindu right. That is, and that's what they keep trying to do, to emulate the grand, symbolic gestures that mark Gandhi's most famous mass movements, right? So, in other words, they have to disavow Gandhi, but at the same time, not very overtly, and they have to keep borrowing and trying to transform his political language and his symbolism. Begins with Charka, Swachh Bharat Abhiyan, etc.
That was really helpful, Professor Basu. So the last chapter extensively elucidates Hindutva 2.0. So I would like to ask you, what is Hindutva 2.0 and how can it be perceived as advertised monotheism, which does not depend on the institutional paraphernalia of modernity or the traditional orders, but grows and persists from the advertised?
Right. So, this book is largely, an exploration of these impasses, these moments of crisis in the Hindutva discourse. So it comes into being the period, political scientists like Benedict Anderson have called their era of print capitalism. That is, an ideology that tries to establish itself through the print media, the modern public sphere, etc. But also in contention with the modern, what Michel Foucault would call the modern disciplines and the physical sciences. That is, in other words, to put it very simply, that you always had to contend with modern secular disciplines in order to say something, right? So in order to propagate a certain myth, you had to fight with history, with archaeology, with, it could be chemistry or physics or, and things like that. In order to say something that is champion something that is of customary belief, you had to, let's say, fight with medical science, right? So all these were there, and you know, you can trace it back to the Calcutta and Pune revivalists of the late 19th century, right? So and they continue even today, right? And what am I trying to say? What I'm trying to say is that if you say that you know, cow urine, gomutra cures cancer, that is the order of modernity is that you can't say it in isolation. You have to engage with existent medical discourse in order to prove that it is right. Right? Or if you say something about the past, that this happened, you know, in the past, in the glorious past, you have to engage with history and archaeologists. So, you know, like roughly about 15 years ago, Murli Manohar Joshi said, the BJP, then BJP minister, said that we have found the ancient city of Dwarka, you know, off the coast of Gujarat, right? Now, that was immediately challenged by marine scientists, marine archaeologists, right? So, and that is where the Sangh Parivar have always faced problems. And, you know, nowadays what we see in the newspapers is that, you know, we see a lot of such statements that are made, that there was internet during the time of Mahabharata, or there was, you know, cow horns can absorb radiation, so, you know, that can, you know, cure cancer, or and a lot of things like that. But that is nothing new. It was there all the time. I mean, it was the late 19th century. It was suggested that the avatars of Vishnu, right, if you put them in correct order, it actually anticipates Darwin. So Darwin wasn't the first one to talk about evolution. Ancient Hindus did that a long time ago. And so on and so forth. There was a track about, you know, the story of Agastya drinking the ocean was actually electrolysis, and so on and so forth. So that is not new. And we've had Hindutva, Hindu nationalist literature down the ages that always tried to, negotiate this this space between traditional understanding and scientific truths, right? But what I find interesting about Hindutva 2.0 is that it is what I call advertised. That is, you don't, this is an ecology where you don't have to complete a story. That is, you know, completing a story means, let us say that, you know, you declared that I believe that the events depicted in the Ramayana took place in 7000 BC. Completing a story means you back it up with archaeological evidence, historical evidence, answer questions by existent, you know, experts, and come up with a cogent, well-rounded, consistent argument that would establish your thesis. So that is the classic modern form of discourse. But advertised modernization, Hindutva as Hindutva 2.0 as advertised modernization, is something different, where you don't have to narrativize propositions. You don't have to, you don't have a narrative obligation. You can just say it. So here I make a distinction between what is narrated and what is advertised. Narration means you have to have a story, and it has to be a wholesome story. It has to have a proper beginning, proper middle, and proper end, and it has to be convincing. And you have to substantiate it, etc., and a lot of other conditions. The advertised form is a form that I think is increasingly important to understand our current moment. In the advertised form, you don't have any obligation to narrate, right? So, I mean, think about it. You see an ad on TV which says that if you drink a particular brand of cola, let's say, if you drink a particular brand of cola, you know, your professional success rate will improve, or your love life will improve, or things like that, right? So if you think about it, there's no logical connection between the two, right? There is no logical connection between, let's say, a Cadbury chocolate bar and cricket. But it's there, it's put together to just give you a feel-good sensation that you can take back home. Take home, as advertisers call it. And Hindutva 2.0 publicity is increasingly following the same pattern. That is, it is no longer reliant on what you would call truth, right? It is, it works through, through distributions. It works through pulsations. That is, it works through memes. It works through images that are instantly dispersible and instantly disposable, right? So it's after a point, it is perhaps pointless to make challenge that by saying, "Look, you are talking about great achievements of this present government, but the picture of the bridge that you have used is not in India, it's in Portugal or somewhere else. Or, you know, what you're saying there is not simply not true." The point is not that. The point is to inundate a certain ecology, informational ecology, with these particularized, parcelized images and associations, and create a kind of a Hindu upper caste male electronic common sense, right? So at the end of the day, I think particular assertions no longer matter. What matters is a kind of a Hindu feeling, urban Hindu upper caste feeling that has been generalized. And that is what what I find interesting. Secondly, in social terms, a lot of us have been talking about the BJP IT cell culture, or the WhatsApp universities, as it is normally referred to. But this is also a kind of a moment where political Hindutva is, to a certain extent, realizing its dreams of the decades, that is, to have a kind of a congregation, even if it is a virtual congregation, that rises above, actual realities of discrimination. So in other words, what I'm saying is, I find this recent phenomenon interesting, whereby caste Hindu groups who can otherwise not eat or drink water at each other's place, can't sit together, can WhatsApp together, right? So what you create is a virtual congregation. And, now where all these things will lead to, how they will be negotiated by a very immense India, India that is full of surprises and, pluralities. Remains to be seen, as I write in the book. I didn't write the book to read the present. Reading the present is the most difficult thing. I just try to understand the ground of the present. I think I'll leave it at that.
Thank you, Professor. You have given the audience a lot of food for thought. And as we arrive at the end of the podcast, I would like to ask you, how would you define the relevance of the book, Hindutva as Political Monotheism, in the present times?
Well, I think, it is a matter of introspection for all of us. I think what the book tries to do is actually ask all parties, in a certain sense, to introspect. And in other words, it does, tries to expose the historical project of Hindu nationalism, right-wing Hindu nationalism, which I sincerely feel is disastrous for the idea of India. But that's, that's what I feel. But hopefully, it will sort of float some questions that, people who call themselves Hindu in general can also ask and ponder over. And I think it's already happening, not just because of my book, but in other words, more and more people are realizing that the kind of narrow, insular, jealous Hindu experience that the Hindu right is offering as the only template of Hindu existence is a very narrow one. That I think many people who are denominationally Hindu are noticing. I hope, this book will be a small contribution in an overall project that I think, I deeply feel is necessary in what is called the left liberal sections. I think people who want to address this very urgent question of Hindutva need to think of a political vernacular of their own, a new political vernacular that can re-energize, secular left and liberal discourses. I don't have an answer insofar as how exactly that can happen, but I think the quest is something that well-meaning people in the academy, outside the academy, need to participate in. Thank you.
Absolutely. There is no growth and development without introspection. Well, thank you so much for answering these questions, which are only a few among the many that our audience still wants to know. Professor Basu, we've taken up a lot of your time, but I must ask you, what are you working on now?
I am in the process of finishing a book on Nehruvian cinema, which is, roughly the cinema that was made after the second plan and 1962. So this, very short period. So Nehruvian cinema, there's a section on Bengal, there's a section on Bombay, what used to be called the Bombay Presidency that time, Bombay State. And there's a section on Bengal. So that is... in other words, broadly speaking, I'm interested in that area because that was when a new India was cinematically imagined, right? It was almost a utopian India that was projected on screens, and I would like to critically revisit that. And I'm also have just started a work on a book on secularism, which I hope to write in the next couple of years. Indian secularism.
That sounds like great projects, Professor. I'm sure everyone is waiting for both the books. I want to thank you for being on the show. I really enjoyed it. Also, thanking the audience for constantly supporting us. Keep reading, keep listening, keep enjoying. Bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.